I'd like to get out your insert this morning, if you would, and follow along as we begin a new series on secrets to exceptional living. Call them secrets because that's what the Ten Commandments are these days. Some studies have shown that 44%, 40, 50% of Protestants and Catholics really don't have a clue as to what the Ten Commandments are. I went to seminary, and I know what it's like to be in a class where the question is asked, what's the first commandment, the one that we're looking at today? And nobody knows. And here's why. There was a missionary in Bunga Bunga Land who was trying to convert a very, very aged chieftain. And he had constantly been talking to this chief, and the missionary was of the old austere, dour, joyless, thou shalt not variety. So he had emphasized this strongly with the chief, and finally the old chief says, let me get this straight. Do I understand you to be saying that I must not take my neighbor's wife? Missionary says, he's hearing me. Yes, that's correct. And is it true, continues the chief, that I'm not to take his ivory or his oxen? Yes, yes, you're getting the picture. And that I must not dance the war dance and then ambush him on the trail and kill him? No, mustn't do that. Absolutely. Well, the chief says, I cannot do any of those things anyway. I'm too old. Too old and to be a Christian, they are the same thing, said the chief. A lot of us think that's what the Ten Commandments are all about. It's something that God gave us that goes under the heading of chewing on a blanket or eating sawdust for breakfast. And there are cereals that taste like that. That it comes under the rubric of something God gave us to ruin our younger years, so we could later on resort to that and ruin other people's lives that come after us, yea, verily. What we fail to see is that the Ten Commandments are meant to be steps, if you will, or secrets, or a description of what life is all about. If you were going to make an ethical map of the good life, it would look like this. That doesn't sink in easily. When I used to hitchhike across the state of Michigan to see a girl in Holland, Michigan, I went there to see tulips, is what I told people. I got picked up one day by a man who engaged me in a conversation on what would make the world a better place. Now, this is back in the Revolution. Some of you, not 1776, but 1969. Some of you remember that. And during the Revolution, we were going to change society. And I remember him engaging me in a discussion about this because I went to a very radical university. And in the course of the discussion, he made the comments, you know, if you sat down and tried to think of 10 rules that would really make society work, you'd come up with the 10 Commandments. And I remember thinking, you would? That had never dawned on me. And I didn't even realize where this guy was coming from. I remember thinking he was a little strange. Now I think, oh, the guy was pretty smart. I want you to get up on the higher levels where I am so that you can see that same thing. I want you to get to the place where you realize the reason God didn't call these the 10 suggestions was because he loves us and values us too much to just allow us to ignore or dismiss these commandments. The fact is, you can't really understand the Bible real well without grasping them because they're fundamental to what goes on in the Bible. You can see it in three ways. One is the way that the Ten Commandments are given is like nothing else in the Bible. God pulled out all the stops. If you think some things we do in here are hot from time to time, you should have seen the smoke, the lighting, the audiovisual effects, the booming voice out of the sky. God's voice speaking. Nothing else quite matches up to the sheer spectacle of the giving of the Ten Commandments. Even DeMille didn't do it justice in his movie. It was about 3 months after they had left Egypt. It was about 3 days after they'd arrived at the mountain, and all of that was going on. There was even what they used to call a sense-around experience. Remember the movie Earthquake came out? They had sense-around, your seats would vibrate. They even had that. Everything. There was even the sound of a blast of a trumpet, whatever that means. Now, that's one thing that shows us how significant it is. The second thing is they were written by God. And that's why I pulled those verses out of chapter 32 at the end of your text. Over and over, this is just one, goes out of its way, the Bible does, to say that, and it's using what's called an anthropomorphism, not that God has flesh and bones, but that he wrote this in an immediate, direct way, which he didn't do with any of the other laws that he gave. Thirdly, it was written on stone, which is a durable form. It's not going to just evaporate 50, 100, 200 years from now. And fourthly, I said three things, but four, it was located, the tablets of the Ten Commandments were located in the holiest place in the temple. It was called the Holy of Holies. Only one person, the high priest, was allowed to go into that room, and only once a year. And those tablets were placed in the Ark of the Covenant underneath what amounted to a throne with the cherubim and all of this, the mercy seat it was called. But it was the throne room of God. Those tablets were under there representing his character. So as you work your way through the Old Testament, the prophets constantly go back to that Ten Commandments, and they call the people constantly to remember those. And when you get into the New Testament, where God's supposed to be nice and mamby-pamby, you know, like Wilford Brimley telling you to eat your oatmeal, when you get into the New Testament, Jesus gives the Sermon on the Mount, but if you examine it, you find it is hardly anything less than an exposition of the Ten Commandments. And as you read through the letters of the apostles to those first Christians, they're telling them, yes, there's a whole new dynamic in your lives that enables you to live this quality of life, but the quality of life is defined by these Ten Commandments. Now, just a real quick word. I know I'm going to get questions as you work through them, because some of you are coming from a Catholic background or other traditions that actually number them. Christians even argue about this. Which of the ten? And some combine this first one I'm doing today and the one I'm doing next week into one commandment, and then they extend the tenth commandment out two steps and that sort of thing. I'm going to give you the true version, of course, but I don't really care which version you do if you just keep them. I don't care how you order them. If you just took them seriously, I think everybody would be pleased about that. But the thing I want you to grasp as we work through these is that the Ten Commandments are not a set of rules to rob us of everything that life is about. Rather, they are fundamental to what real life and energy and creativity and excellence, as Al spoke about a moment ago, what I'm going to call exceptional living, singular lives. And the very first step to that is what the first commandment is all about. It's the first step. It's a commitment, exclusive and total devotion to God. And if you're like me and every other human being that has what amounts to an allergic reaction to God, you sort of think, ah, yikes. And the real tragedy here is the very thing we have to do the most is the thing we're most afraid of. I want to talk about this morning. I want to talk about four fundamental truths that I think you need to appreciate and understand in order to overcome that hump of fear, that resistance to really making what constitutes an ultimate commitment to God. And here's the first reality that you need to grasp. Number one, you can't separate God's glory from our good. You can't separate God's glory from our good. We tend to think that what glorifies God, quote unquote, is going to mean something really bad for us, rather than seeing that it's exactly the other way around. Here's why you can't separate God's glory and what's good for us. Number one, only God is worthy. Only God is God. He's the only one worthy of ultimate, complete devotion. Notice down here in verse 2 in chapter 20, God spoke these words, verse 20, I am, in verse 2, and in verse 3, you shall. The I am precedes the you shall. It's because of who God is and what he's done that he calls us to live in a certain way, and you can't separate those two things. You never achieve exceptional living until you begin to grasp who God is. He is God. You're not. That's news for some of us. It's news for Shirley MacLaine and other people that stand on the beach. Did you see that movie? I am God. God is within me. See, all gods are not the same. I'm getting ahead of myself. God is God. God is infinite. Are you infinite? Let me talk to your spouse. Let me talk to your boss. Let me get out those old report cards from your teacher. We'll see how omniscient you are. That means all-knowing. Oh, that. I didn't even know what the word meant. See what I mean? Omnipotent, eternal, infinite in space, transcendent is the big word that people use. You see, these commandments express who God is. Now, Plato and Socrates and others come along. Confucius, this is the way you ought to walk in it. But when God gives commandments, they are an expression of his very nature, of who he is. He is life. He's the only one who has life in himself and is self-existent. Everyone, other life is derivative and dependent, like you and me. We don't control our own lives. We saw a major celebrity die from this town this week, and we never know when that's going to happen. We don't have control over our lives, but God is infinite. He has life. We're derivative. That means that we have to be in touch with him to have that life. I may as well be a planet pretending that I am the sun, that the universe revolves around me. As a matter of fact, intellectuals used to argue that. They used to say that the earth was the center of the universe, and it was obvious because if you look, all the stars go around us. You can see it every night. And then Copernicus came along and said, oh, do you know what? We're just a little planet in a big solar system around an average sun in a fairly mediocre galaxy in this vast cosmos. And people go, no, that couldn't be true. And that's what people called a Copernican revolution in intellectual history. And when you begin to discover that God is God and you're not, that is a Copernican revolution in spiritual terms. Only God is worthy. Secondly, we can only know ourselves by knowing God, and that's because we're made in God's image. A child grows up wanting to know the edges of his identity. This is hard to explain, and yet all of us sense down inside what I'm talking about. We want to know, who am I? How do I define myself? And we look to our parents. We study them. We mimic them. They do good things or bad things. We do the same kind of things. If they waddle and quack, we waddle and quack. But you can't know yourself apart from knowing your family and those people around you. You can't know yourself ultimately. If I'm a creature of God and made in His image, I can't know who I am until I discover who God is. You see what I'm saying? So to engage God and be involved with Him means I find out who I am. Now, for those of you who cannot read the cartoon this morning, let me tell you what it is. It's a man in a desert. That's a vast wilderness. And he comes upon one of these directional signs, a map, and all it is a blank canvas with one little dot down there and a little arrow and legend that says, you are here. Now, that's funny, you see, because it doesn't tell him anything. There are no reference points to where he is. It's just a blank with a dot on it. And unless we have reference points, you and I don't know who we are. We're as lost as this man in the cartoon is. And if we don't end up worshiping God, we're going to define ourselves in some other terms. We're going to be like Carl Sagan, who stands out and looks at the cosmos, this vast, awesome machine, and says, I'm just a piece of flotsam in that machine. Or I'm going to be John Denver and identify myself with the Rocky Mountains. Or I'm going to relate to something bigger than myself. Or I'm going to idolize Elvis and try to achieve Elvis consciousness. Somewhere, somehow, you watch this psychology, people have to key into something bigger than themselves. There's an anxiety, what you could call a fire in the soul, to know who I am and to define myself in terms of something bigger than I am, transcendent over me. It's the call of my ancestry. Now, even modern atheists and agnostics recognize the problem. I found a very striking example in Stephen Hawking, who some of you know is this astonishing mathematician at the University of Cambridge, Cambridge University. And he made a statement which he wanted to rule God out of the picture. Listen, quote, my proposal is the statement that the universe is a closed system. We don't need to suppose there's something outside the universe which is not subject to its law. It is the claim that the laws of science are sufficient to explain the universe. Did you get that? The laws of science are sufficient to explain the universe. Then he goes on and argues about TOE, T-O-E, theory of everything. And he makes this comment. He says, even if we had a theory of everything, however, we would still be left with one final question. What is it that breathes fire into the equations, the mathematical equations, and makes a universe for them to describe? If I knew that, I would know everything important. Was it too subtle? He says, we can explain everything with mathematics. And then he says, but you know, there's some romance in the rose. There's some X factor here that we can't explain and put into an equation. If I knew that, I would know everything. Well, you've just opened the door to the idea of what God is all about. We're saying there, we're not less than those truths that science discovers, but we're so much more. And we don't want to reduce ourselves down to that. So, this means that this commandment, well, no, let me back up. Freud made the comment, this is the man who explained human nature, remember? The meager satisfaction that man can extract from reality leaves him starving. That was his comment. Hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, Socrates said, all of the wisdom of this world is but a tiny raft upon which we must set sail when we leave this earth. If only there was some firmer foundation on which to sail, perhaps some word from God. That's what Socrates said. Now, look down here, verse 20, verse 1. And God spoke. Now, maybe, like me, you've had some real intellectual questions with that. Well, didn't men write this, and doesn't it have lots of errors, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I know all those questions, but it's sufficient for this morning to note the claim. God says, I am speaking. Yeah, I know Moses wrote this down. I know David, Zechariah. I know all those dudes. I'm the one speaking. And doesn't it make sense that if God made us able to verbalize and communicate with one another, that He'd be perfectly capable of stooping down to our level and communicating on terms that we can understand? There's nothing inherently illogical about that idea. That's what the Bible claims to be. God says, I'm going to give you a map since I designed you. Here's the owner's manual. And this is my third point. First of all, God is worthy. Secondly, we can only know ourselves by knowing God. And thirdly, God designed us to run. These commandments reflect our design. That's what I'm saying. These commandments reflect our design. In the same way that your owner's manual in your car, which tells you to change the oil every so often, is reflecting something about the design of that car, and you're free to ignore that. Don't change the oil at all if you don't want to. Perish the thought that we'd mess with your free will. But then you won't be free to drive your car. You can do anything you want. You can sow any kind of seed out there in the garden you want, but you're not free to reap what comes out of there. It's going to depend upon whether you're living according to the owner's manual. You cannot escape your finitude. You cannot escape your creaturehood. You cannot escape the being that God has made you and me to be. So, the first reason that we ought to heed, take this seriously, this ultimate commitment, is because you can't separate God's glory and our good. To make Him the center is to become fulfilled in everything that He has made us to be. He made us to function on devotion to Him the way we design automobiles to run on gas. No gas, you don't get anywhere. Same here. Now, the next point that we need to grasp is that false gods are hazardous to your health. And this flows from the first one. If it's true that God is a certain way and He's made us to function in a certain way, and instead of being devoted to Him, we devote ourselves to some other kind of God, some other kind of fuel in the tank, if you will, it stands to reason that we're going to have a breakdown. And we're living in a world with all kinds of competing gods. Now look down here, He says, you shall have no other gods before Me. Now, does that mean that there are really other gods? I don't think so, not from what I read in the Bible. But I think He's talking to some people that aren't philosophers with those kind of picky questions. They knew perfectly well that there are all kinds of gods surrounding them. And He's talking in their language to say, don't pay any attention to those other gods. You need to be committed to Me. This brings us back to the point I made a moment ago, which is that if we don't devote ourselves to the true God, we're going to end up giving ourselves to some other higher thing, some sort of social cause or some sort of celebrity or some sort of company or public opinion or something else. Because we were made to commit to something higher. We can never escape that. And so you can't find anywhere in the world a culture that doesn't have some kind of religion. Now, modern people come along and say, well, look at that. Everybody has a different religion, so I guess none of them are false or true. And I would turn that exactly around and say, if every culture has this religious impulse, which it cannot deny, there must be some true version out there of which these are all corruptions. There's got to be some core of truth of which these are all some kind of reflection. And if I don't understand what that is, it can be tragic. Bill Hybels tells about going to a tribal village in Paraguay where he watched in horror as poverty-stricken, disease-stricken people bowed down before a hunk of stone and paid homage to that piece of stone. How can you look at that and not think that's tragic? Because I'm assuming most of us here would say, that's not a god, it's a piece of rock. I learned that in geology class. But you see, there are other gods that we can bow down before that are not as obvious. In Moses' day, there were all kinds of gods, the Baals and so on. In fact, it was a polytheistic culture. It's like going into your clothes closet and there's all kinds of things for every occasion. You had a god for every occasion. Your crops fail, you have a god for that. Need rain, you have a god for that. It's real handy. It's like credit cards. You just pull out the one you need and use it. Or reduce it down to one god, that was an awesome thought. But if that's the only God there is, it's important that we have an accurate perception of Him. My sincerity doesn't create truth. I can sincerely believe in something false, and it's still false. Let me give you a contemporary example. In April 1978, there was a 15-month-old baby that came down with a fever. His parents belonged to one of these types of churches that does not believe in doctors and says that what we need is faith. And if we have faith, God will heal this child. So they prayed. And I'm not questioning anybody's sincerity or devotion or how many hours they prayed or that they didn't pray in the right position, you know, and they needed to be in gravity boots instead of or something. The technique isn't the issue here at all. They were totally sincere. But as the weeks went on, this child developed a very high fever. And he even went blind. And even then, they didn't stop praying for him. In fact, one Sunday, the pastor gave a particularly rousing sermon at the church they attended on faith and the need to really believe. And when they went home from church, they found their child still blue and dead. And even then, the denial continued, and they sought to pray that God would resurrect this child. Now, their problem wasn't that they didn't have a lot of faith. Their problem was their faith was in a false God. And the consequences can be tragic. There needs to be a warning label out there somewhere. I don't know who's going to do it. I don't want the government doing it. But it needs to say, warning, false gods can be hazardous to your spiritual health. I notice as I go through the world that people will say, oh, I'm a very, they want to say this to padres like myself. I'm a very spiritual person. I'm into spirituality. And I think that's great. But not every spirituality is the same. There are true spiritualities and there are pseudo false spiritualities. In Moses' day, God had to say just one, not many. Today we have to say there is a God rather than not any. Many people question, although polls say that 85% of Americans believe in a God of some sort. But there are those who still wrestle, is he really out there and what is he really like? There are all kinds of idols once you grasp what an idol is. It's not just something you can touch and feel and handle, but it's anything that dominates your thoughts, that experiences your obeisance and homage, that draws on your energy and time and totally dominates your life. It's what you think about in quiet moments. Now, when you define an idol that way, Packer says, your God is what you love, seek, worship, serve, and allow to control you. Then you realize, oh, there are all kinds of false gods out there. And I don't have time to pursue them all. In my reading, I uncovered several little paradigms I thought were cute. I'll share them with you. Sex, shekels, and stomach. Sex, shekels, and stomach. Ponder that. Those are three gods for a lot of people. Some of us make gods out of other people. What Run Writer called football, the firm, Freemasonry, and the family. Football. Maybe I do need to elaborate on these a little bit more. Pleasure, possessions, and position. If I spend my life seeking after position, if I spend my life pursuing the acquisition of material things and say, that will define my life, that will give me meaning, that is what abundant living is all about. I am pursuing a false God. I am devoting myself to that God. If it's sex or drugs or any other type of thing which dominates my life, that's my idol. And God says, nyet, you must be totally and exclusively devoted to me. G.K. Chesterton once said that when we don't believe in the Christian God, we don't believe in nothing, we believe in anything. In other words, when you're not devoted to the true God, you end up in slavery and bondage to many, many, many gods. Have singular devotion to one God is to say, this is the one I need to concentrate my energies on and not everybody else. And I'm not pulled in 50 directions. And everything I do in life is an expression to some degree of my devotion to that one true God. And it liberates me. It frees me so that I don't have to jump and beck and call of every false God that comes along. So the reason I ought to be fully devoted to God, make an ultimate commitment to Him, in the words of this first commandment or secret, is first of all because it's for my good. It's for God's glory, but that's for my good. And secondly, anything else is going to be hazardous to my spiritual health. It's not going to work. Thirdly, and this is really important, God has given us His heart before He asked for ours. God has given us His heart before He asked for our heart. A lot of us think of love and grace as being, grace and law and grace being opposites. And we think of the Ten Commandments as severe and God saying, thou shalt not. And over here is love. But the setting of the severe thou shalt nots is a setting of love and grace. Would you note again verse 2? I'm the God who brought you out of Egypt. Do you understand what Egypt is? Egypt was slavery. Egypt was bondage. It was long hours. It was painful toil. It was meaningless feeling servitude. It was having to do what any Egyptian told you to do, never being able to live the American dream. That was Egypt. And He says, I brought you out of that. You didn't make me do it. I came when I was good and ready. I came at my own initiative. God is saying, you witnessed the network battle of the gods. We had the Egyptian gods over there, all of those gods, and just one God over here with His hand tied behind His back. And we saw the hail and the fire and the blood and the bugs, and we saw all those plagues. And the last thing we saw was this freeway through the Red Sea, which collapsed onto the Egyptian army. That's the God I am. That's why. Because I have extended my power on your behalf in all these areas. That's why, he says, you ought to make me number one. No kidding. The very fact that they're even standing there hearing these commandments is because of God's grace. The reason this is important, we tend to think, if I can just jump over that bar, those Ten Commandments, then God will love me. And a lot of us, the reason we don't know the Ten Commandments is so we don't know how far short we fall of getting to that bar. We don't even come close, this one included. But it's showing us, here's what life is all about. And no, we can't live up to it. But God is saying, I already brought you out here. So I'm giving you the commandment in the context of grace. And we need to hear that very, very clearly. Let me put this another way. Here's the question we ought to ask of every false god. Quote, what have you done for me lately? End quote. Now that might sound very selfish and self-centered to you, but God could say, well, 10 plagues, sent a deliverer. We really iced the Pharaoh, didn't we? We took care of all those Egyptian gods and I pulled you out. We're going to head to the promise. That's what I've done for you lately. That's the basis on which I want you to devote yourself to me because I have already given my heart to you. These other gods are like the ones in the Old Testament. They would mock them out. We'll look at it next week. They mock other gods. You know, they just laugh. We ought to be laughing at some of the things going on in the world. It's pathetic. It's tragic. But it's also comic. Think of these idols, you know, and you carve out the eyes. Well, Isaiah has a satire. A guy goes into the wood, cuts down a tree, goes home, carves it, shapes it, sets up an idol, and he bows down to it. And he thinks, that's crazy. It really is. We can see that when it's 2,500 years ago. We just can't see that some of the ludicrous theories that we come up with aren't just as ridiculous. There's an idol that has eyes, but he can't see. He has ears, he can't hear. He has little wooden feet that can't move. He can't rescue you, can't do anything for you. A lot of gods are like that. This God isn't. And not only can he do it, he has already done it. That's what Christ is about. That God came into the world as a human being to accomplish something with his life, death, and resurrection that frees us from those inner binds that keep us from experiencing exceptional living. He's already given us his heart. Well, now you look at this, you think, why the stern tone? I mean, I'm still uncomfortable. This isn't the kind of God that I think we ought to have in America. He's too stern. I'd rather have Wilford Brimley. He's grumpy, but he's lovable. But these commandments, I mean, who are we talking about? We've got to look at the historical context. These are a bunch of slaves that don't know any more about being a nation than a little kid knows how to tie his shoes. I mean, they have never been a nation. They've never functioned as a society in this way. They've been slaves, totally dependent on another master culture. Now they've got to take responsibility for their lives. They're unruly, they're uncivilized, they're rowdy, and history will bear everything out that I'm saying. And so God has to come down like teachers do the first week of school. I had 3 children start school this week. I figure that and being hit by a truck are pretty much the same kind of experience. My wife is a teacher. Here's what I've learned from her, that in a classroom on the first day, you're not a nice teacher. Any teacher who does that doesn't know what she's doing. You always get their respect before you get their love. You don't go in and try to get the class to like you. You get the class to go by the rules. Once they're doing that, then the channels are free so that real love can take place. Isn't that interesting? You can argue philosophy all you want. You can read your psych books and, you know, but when it comes to putting the rubber on the road and how people function and how you need to relate to people and engage them, that's how you've got to behave with them. I think God's doing the same thing here. He says, look, this is a ship. I'm the captain. We don't vote. If you want to vote, fine. We got 30 men here. You vote. I have 40 votes. Go ahead and vote. That's God's attitude. I also think there's something to be said for clarity here. When you have a little child that could run into the street, you don't sit down and debate, say, let's read some books, let's write some papers, let's discuss this thing, let's have a true, genuine, personal I-thou encounter here. You don't get bogged down in the touchy-feely stuff. You say, "You go out. If you go out in that street, I'm going to kill you." You put down a rule so the kid says, wow, she's really hot, he's really mad, I better not go out in that street. It's not the time for niceties because it's literally a life or death situation, and your toddler is not going to grasp all that. Now, I think we have the advantage of centuries that they didn't have. But God's still God. But I think in this situation, he's just... And if you were standing at the mountain, we wouldn't even be having this debate, see? We're centuries later. But if you were there, I don't think you would have thought, now, God, do you need to speak to us in that tone of voice? I think you would have thought, boy, you would have done what they did. You think the ground was shaken? You should have seen their knees. Literally, they were trembling. They pleaded for Moses to go up and talk to God and just relay it to them because the whole thing was so utterly traumatic in their lives. Is your view of God that big? Clarity. Now, I can sit down and talk about transcendent sexuality. It's just got a great ring to it, doesn't it? We can talk about the dynamics and the ins and outs of why we ought to do this, that, and the other thing, but God wants to be clear. And I could debate those things, but God says, no, keep sex for marriage. Keep sex under control or it'll eat you up. And you go, well, what do you mean? And he says, I mean, don't fool around with your neighbor's spouse. And you go, oh, that. Okay. Clear. Even you and I can understand what he's saying. The problem with the Ten Commandments really isn't that they're too subtle. We just can't. What are you really trying to say to me, God? The real problem is we know perfectly well what he's trying to say. We just don't like what he's trying to say. Until we begin to grasp that these are steps to an exceptional life. Even the negative tone highlights grace. God doesn't like sin because he made us, he values us, he cherishes us. He hates things that destroy our lives. He's angry about sin. We oughtn't to take that privilege away from him. But the fact that he's angry about it says something about how deeply he values and cherishes us. Has that occurred to you? That one of the reasons he is so hot and angry about injustice in the world is because what it does to you and me? Do you not feel some bit of that when you read the paper and you see these things that happen that you just think, that is terrible? I find there are things that are on the news, 2020, primetime live, whatever, and I think, I don't want to watch this. I'm not in the mood to see how ugly the world can be tonight. I'd rather eat popcorn and escape into something totally frivolous. We all know that feeling, but then sometimes you watch them and you become angry about them. That's what God's like. Elie Wiesel, the Nobel laureate, who is also a survivor of a death camp, said this about his experience in prison camps. Quote, the worst torture is when the torturer comes to you and tells you no one believes you are alive anymore. They have all given up on you. You are abandoned. That is the most frightening possibility, ladies and gentlemen. And what this commandment says, that God has not abandoned us. He sent his own son into the world for us to get us out of Egyptian bondage, quote-unquote, bondage to sin, servitude to sin, and to enable us to live an exceptional life. That's the basis for following these secrets. So first of all, it's for our good. It reflects our design. Secondly, false gods are hazardous to our health. Thirdly, God didn't ask for our heart before he already gave us his heart. And fourthly, you're going to have trouble spelling this unless you're really good, but it just sounds neat. Intimacy and exclusivity go together. Intimacy and exclusivity go together. The deepest relationships are exclusive relationships. If you want to tap into the deepest joys of the human experience, there's got to be a commitment to exclusivity in that relationship. Theodore Roosevelt once said about patriotism, the man who loves other countries as much as his own stands on a level with the man who loves other women as much as he loves his own wife. Try this on your wife. Honey, I don't love her any more than I love you. Well, okay, just so long as it's not anymore. If I see that, I'm really going to get mad. Now, you see, God is a person. And when you engage a person in the kind of intimate relationship, depth means narrowness. You're either a mile wide and an inch thick, like people are today, or you decide, one woman, one man, I'm going to go deep in that relationship. That culture thinks it's so enlightened about sex, and it doesn't know the first thing because it has no idea what exclusivity is about. And I could quote plenty of non-Christians who would say that. God's a person. Now, if God were the force like Star Wars, he would simply be a spiritual technology, and we master a technique to exploit him. That's at the heart of most Eastern-type mystical thinking, which is running riot through our culture today. But if he is a person, whenever we engage in relationships with one another, there need to be certain boundaries, standards, conduct that's carried out. You can't get married and act just any way you want. I mean, you can, but you can't get what you got into marriage to get by doing that. There's got to be a structure to the relationship. The Ten Commandments are telling us, this is how we're going to get along. This is why I designed you, but this is how people function together. technically, this is subtle, this is for you scholars out there, the Ten Commandments are not technically law at all. They're covenant. Okay. One of those subtle distinctions, but it's just worth noting that they're not law, like driving on the right-hand side of the road is law in this country. It's covenantal. It's never called the law. It's called the Ten Words, or the words of the covenant. And a covenant structures a relationship between two people. What that means is that the heart of Christianity is not obeying rules, it's devotion to a person. And these rules, quote unquote, simply define what that devotion looks like. Do you get the difference? See, a lot of us think, as long as I don't rob a bank, I must be keeping the Ten Commandments. Do you know anybody that's robbed a bank? I do. I hope this tape doesn't find its way there, but many years ago, I was in a large church as an interim pastor, and the new pastor had just come on board, and somebody called the office and said, so-and-so in your church just robbed a bank this afternoon. And the senior pastor came to me and says, I'm new here, I don't know what's going on, you come with me. And I remember thinking, and what? We go over and meet them. I mean, I didn't know these people. This is a 1,100 people church, and I'd been relatively new myself. I didn't know this person. We go over and we sit down, and we talk about whether the rain will hurt the rhubarb, and you know, all sorts of, you know, it's so nice to meet you. Come on in. Would you like some tea? Would you like some cookies? And I'm sitting there the whole time thinking, what class did I take that told me how to open the conversation about bank robbery in this setting? And I finally said something about as subtle as, are you the lady that robbed a bank? And she burst into tears. She says, yes. She is telling me about this bank she robbed. Just thought I'd share that this morning. The real tragedy in all of this is some of us are thinking, well, I never did that. I never robbed a bank, so I'm pretty good. But did you devote yourself to God? God isn't just saying, okay, you did that rule, like it's some obstacle course. He wants to know, do you love me? One of the lawyers, you know, this is a culture that invented 1,537 blue laws about the Sabbath. 1,537. Anyway, a lawyer comes to Jesus and said, which is the greatest commandment? And he says, love God with all of your heart, your soul, your strength, even your mind. That's interesting. And we back off from that. You know his words down here where he says, you shall have no other gods before me? That phrase, before me, if you look at parallel passages, it's passages used of taking a second wife while your first one's still alive. In other words, we're supposed to be married. Who is this person that's sitting in front of my face? That's kind of what God is saying. I don't want any other gods in my face. I am your God. It's kind of amazing, isn't it, that God is even that jealous and he cares that much about being our God and he doesn't want anybody else crowding his turf because he made us? Exclusivity means I put all my energies into that relationship. Now get this. If you don't take the first law, the first commandment, the first secret seriously, why fool with the other nine? If the heart of this whole thing is devotion to God, so what that you never committed adultery in your life? So what you never robbed a bank? Biggest deal. You missed the most important thing of all. But if that first step, and there's an order and a progression to these, if you get the first step right, then everything else starts to flow out of that. And you discover that, oh, this stuff works. Do you know why Christianity doesn't work? You know why God is so distant and so unreal to people? Because they're not committed. I quoted this before. It was a congressman who was asked his views about whiskey. Quote, I just love this. If you mean the demon drink that poisons the mind, pollutes the body, desecrates family life, and inflames sinners, I'm against it. But if you mean the elixir of Christmas cheer, the shield against winter chill, the taxable potion that puts funds into public coffers that comfort little children, crippled children, I'm for it. This is my position, and I will not compromise. Some of us are that way. I'm for God. If you mean the God that loves and coddles and never comes and slaps my wrist and says, I love you too much to let you play in the traffic, I'm for that God. But if you mean the one that comes in and is going to mess up my life and actually, well, be God, well, I'm against it. That's my position and I won't compromise. Work tongue. Is God the CEO in your life? Does he, the chairman of the board, does he sit at the head of the table? Is he really God? Is he the ultimate authority? You may be like a compass. You can take it out, flip it around, toss it back and forth, throw it like a frisbee, and that needle is going to spin all over the place. But when it sits there at rest and that compass needle points back north, where does your needle point? When you're alone at night, drifting off to sleep, does God come to your thoughts or other things? When you're by yourself, when you have those free moments and you can do something with Him, does God figure into that at all? Do you see Him as some little sliver of your life to be contained, or do you see Him as someone who is in intimate partnership with you in every dimension of life, and it becomes exciting and energizing and enervating? Every one of these commandments is spoken to individuals. You, specifically, Harvey, Sheila, whoever, you shall have no other gods before Me. That's the challenge. Now, I can't end without saying this. None of us is able to do this perfectly. I mean, I hope what I say next doesn't, my tone earlier didn't belie what I'm about to say. But I didn't come here to help you pack your bags for a guilt trip. I would have you note that if you're, you know, over here, maybe you need to look at the map and get over here and say, well, I have to attend to this. And I ought to at least begin praying and say, God, help me make You the number one thing in my life. None of me included. In fact, I probably know as much or more about how far short I fall of this than many of you do. I've been studying this thing all week long. It was terrible. Are you the kind of person, when you get lost, gets out a map and looks? You know what I do? And you're married to the opposite. You're one or the other. Not me. I'm a homing pigeon. We'll just drive around here and see if we can't find this sucker. We've had more scenic route. We've seen a lot of life that way. And if you ignore the map, you can see a lot of life. Sure, you can go down over in the gutter and look if you want. But if you want exceptional living, get out the map and look at it. You got to make a decision. You can't be like the guy that's married to the girl. Of course I love you, honey. I moved in with you. I know, but you've never committed to me. Well, what's a commitment? Try that one. It's only standing up in front of people and saying, no, you're the one. Not just late at night in passionate moments. Not when I'm writing corny love songs am I going to say, I'll love you forever. But I'm going to say it legally in every sense of life. You're the one. I'm hooked to you for life, babe. Let's go. Now, we have to make a decision. I can believe in God, but to make a decision is different. You know what Augustine said hundreds of years ago? I'm almost done. He said, love God and do what you like. Get this first commandment right, the rest flow from it. The modern materialist says, just do what you like. And you know what happens? He goes and pays money to psychoanalysts to help him know, how come I don't like anything? Life lost its zest. And then you got religious uptight Pharisees who just say, don't do what you like and don't love. There are people who go around and do that too. Love God and do what you like. It comes only from making the ultimate commitment. Let's pray. As we close this morning, let's ask God to help us get out the map. Let's pray. Lord, there isn't one of us that has taken this seriously enough in our lives, but we want to live singular, exceptional lives. Help us to do that. Lord, some of us may be sitting here saying, I don't even know if You exist. Then help us to say to You, God, do You exist? Show me that. And Lord, we may realize that, well, I believe all these things, but I've never really trusted You. I've never really asked Christ to come into my life. Then help us to say that from our heart. Forgive us for all of our sins. Help us to be the people You made us to be. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.